Today is March 30th, 2010. We are at the University Club Room at San Diego State University, Library and Information Access, interviewing Mr. Harold Brown for oral history project and Creating Communities project for Special Collections and University Archives. Good morning, Mr. Brown.
Good morning, Gloria.
And I'm going to ask you some basic questions, and I'm going to let you go with the flow.
Okay.
When and where were you born?
I was born in a town by the name of York, Y-O-R-K, Pennsylvania. Okay. I was born May 6, 1934. York, Pennsylvania is a born into a working class town and a working class community. I'm the youngest of seven children, and three of us are still living. The others are deceased.
Okay. Can you tell me a little bit about your parents and family background?
Yes. I didn't have a father, so I grew up without a father, but I grew up with a very strong, loving and caring mother.
Okay.
Who was tough as nails, and she supported us. My brothers, being the youngest, I was there when my older siblings were gone, married and gone. But she. She was a domestic and other kinds of, and did other kinds of jobs to earn enough, and also through the welfare system, was able to care for us. And she lived to be a ripe old age of 94.
Wow, that's wonderful. Mm-hmm. So you felt almost like an only child, huh, there for a while?
Well,
did you have any brothers and sisters at home when you were going to school?
One sister who is 7 years older than me, and one brother who is 4 years older than me. And so I grew up kind of with them as my older siblings. And then the others were around, but they weren't actually living in the house, except for my one brother who recently passed away. He came back and lived with us. But I had a very, very fun growing up.
Okay.
In spite of everything, it was. We didn't have money, and we didn't have any kind of influence in the community, but we just enjoyed, and we didn't know we were poor, and we knew we were poor, but everyone else was poor within the black community.
So, and that's what I tell people all the time. We were very poor, but we really didn't know it, because everyone lived that same sort of socioeconomic realm, and we had family, and that was kind of what was important. So.
We had family, we had
food,
love, and security, and had enough food to eat.
Absolutely.
Although it wasn't the right kinds of food as we look at today, but we had food to eat. And we had enough to get by on. We had friends and relatives and so forth. The biggest, I won't say the biggest, but one of the great impacts on my growing up was living in a town where there were segregated communities and job discrimination, which was characteristic of America.
Right.
And all of the towns that I knew about growing up around Pennsylvania and so forth, I mean, we were all under the same conditions. We had segregated communities where we were confined to live and had very few jobs, and of those we had were the lowest paying jobs, no housing integration, and so we went to segregated schools for at least through the elementary years. So that was one that had a significant impact on my life, much more so than not having money, not having food.
What was the workforce in that area? Other than, you know, domestic for the women, basically.
Well, the workforce, I mean, there was farming in that area, but in the urban areas, there was just, you know, a lot of retail, and there were a few companies that hired numbers of people, but, you know, no large manufacturing.
Was the farming like sharecropping farming in the South, or
no? This was just a lot of corn farming, and this was all outside of the city of York. It was mostly around in the county areas.
So you were not born in San Diego. So
no.
What brought you to San Diego, and when did you arrive in San Diego?
Well, I came to San Diego in 1953. My days of growing up involved a lot of sports.
Okay.
And yeah. I was fortunate enough to have some skills in that area. And so I was invited to come to San Diego State on a basketball and baseball scholarship.
Okay.
And I was, after high school, I was guided by my mentors in high school to attend Penn State University, which I did. And during my freshman year, I found that there was no scholarship there for me for some reason, which I've never been able to determine what that was. But there was no scholarship, and so I stayed there for one semester and came to the place called San Diego State College.
Okay.
And I was, the way I knew
it. So you were recruited here? Or someone knew someone who knew someone who?
There were two people who played for San Diego State, two fellas who were out here, I think, through the Navy and ended up going to San Diego State and playing basketball at San Diego State. They're from my hometown.
Okay.
They knew about me in high school, where I was all-state basketball player and so on, and so they came around to my house, talked to me about going to San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, going to where? So I had already committed to go to Penn State, which I did, but when things didn't turn out at Penn State, I ended up telling the coach out here that I was, you know, going to leave Penn State, and of course he had still extended the invitation to come to San Diego State, which I did.
Okay. On a scholarship.
Yes.
Okay.
That's a story in itself. It doesn't sound as, the scholarship is not as people think today of scholarships. I mean, people go to scholarships, like my son, our youngest son went to Stanford on a basketball scholarship.
Oh, okay.
And Stanford, you know, at that time, 1981, I mean, the tuition was about $20,000 or something like that. When I came to San Diego State on a scholarship, my tuition was $30.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So people get confused.
How times have changed.
How times have changed. Well, it was $30 per semester and a job.
Okay.
Which, you know.
At the time, that was really good. Yeah, so they paid for you moving to the West Coast.
No.
No, you had to.
You had to get here. And you had to, have a place to live, right. Have a place to eat, and that sort of thing. So I stayed at San. In fact, so much involved in these answers. But I came here as
Oh, that's fine. Take your time.
I came to San Diego State and primarily to play basketball and baseball. Because I had dreams of becoming a professional baseball player and couldn't consider basketball. I was not nearly tall enough to play basketball. So I thought maybe baseball, and I had been invited by the St. Louis Browns minor league training
so camp. You are good.
to play baseball and which I went there in Thomasville, Georgia for training.
Okay. But approximately what year was that?
That was 1950, right after I left Penn State. So that was 1952.
So in between the time you came to San Diego State?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay.
And so I, went to spring training and ended up with the injuries and so forth, and went back home and just waited to return to school, which was then going to be San Diego State. So in the September of 1953, I came to San Diego State.
Okay.
And when I got here, people familiar with sports know that when you transfer from one university to another, you have to wait out a year for eligibility. So when I came to San Diego, the coach here, knowing that I would have to wait a year, said, you know, what you should do is go to the community college, which was junior college, San Diego Junior College then.
Okay.
And he said, go there, and then you can still play for a year and keep your skills up, and it won't count toward your eligibility. Well, upon investigation there, I found out that was not true, that once I, wherever I played after my initial year of playing ball at a university, wherever you played, it still counted toward your eligibility.
Okay.
So I went there for a year, and so I ended up not playing until I came to San Diego State.
Because had you played there, then you would have only had 3 years of eligibility at San Diego State.
I would have only had two.
Two.
Because I played at Penn State my freshman year.
Okay.
But I didn't finish my freshman year. I stayed there for one semester. Came to San Diego and went to the junior college for a year. And then...
What junior college?
That was San Diego Junior College. It's
what now, is it now?
It's
San Diego
it's
City?
San Diego City.
City College, okay. Mm-hmm.
And so I went to... I was drafted in the Army during that time. And I spent 2 years in the Army.
Okay.
And then came back to San Diego.
Where were you stationed when you were in the Army?
I was stationed mostly at Fort Monmouth, New Jersey. I was in the Signal Corps. I was a Signal Corps.
I'm not familiar. What's Signal Corps?
Communications.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Communications.
Oh, okay.
They called it Signal Corps. So, yeah, I ended
Was that
up
a good experience? Army? I mean, I know you had no choice in the matter, but...
I wouldn't describe it as a good experience. It was an obligation.
Okay.
You know, that...
That's fair.
We fulfilled and made it through that and came back to school.
So, what were your impressions of school? Were you a student athlete or an athlete student?
When I started out, I'll go back to high school to answer that. In high school, I had some very good mentors, and they were always reminding me, although I was a star, mm-hmm. in quotes, athlete, they reminded me how that, you know, education is important, and don't be, I forget the term that my one teacher used to use, don't grow up to be a dumb jock.
Okay.
And so that stuck with me, although...
That's very good advice to
yes,
write today.
Yes, it was. Yeah. It sure is. So I came to, you know, accept the fact that education was important, but still, I was a basketball player and a baseball player, and I had aspirations to continue that mm-hmm. in college and then wherever else that I could play. I loved sports, and I was good at it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I ended up at San Diego State I played in the Army, then played here, but the more I got into college, I think probably during the years at the San Diego City College. Now, when I was there, education became more and more important to me.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, when I came to San Diego State, I mean, I was like all of my teammates. We were students who actually played sports, played basketball, played baseball, but we were students.
Okay.
And the education was the main reason then for being in school, mm-hmm. not to play sports.
Right. What was your major?
I started as a physical education major.
Okay.
Which you know, every time you ask these questions, it unveils all kinds of other stories. I grew up wanting to be a teacher. And
so did I, because that was what people were. African Americans were teachers.
Yes.
I tell people they were teachers or preachers.
Yes, so. Exactly. That's all I knew. I mean, my exposure was to teachers,
mm-hmm.
and I wanted to be a teacher. And what did I love doing? I loved sports, and I loved.
So that was a natural.
That was a natural. So I declared physical education as a major, and then as I got more involved into in the college, I decided I wanted to be a speech therapist, which is now called speech pathology.
Right.
And so then I went off into speech and took courses and so forth along those lines, and I got to the point where I got very tired, and I was ready to, you know, my eligibility was finished, playing mm-hmm. ball, and I was ready to get out and go to work. And so I decided to take my degree in physical education and then finish my work in speech pathology, which I didn't do. I saw myself as having a clinic.
Okay.
A speech clinic,
mm-hmm.
and which I never did. I went and I got a teaching job, teaching physical education here in San Diego, and at a junior high school, which they call most middle schools now.
Right.
But
we're good.
Are we? So I.
How long did you teach at a middle school?
I taught. I was there 6 years.
And what middle school was that?
Started at Einstein Junior High School. And I was there for a year, and then half of the of the faculty we went over to open up it was Hale Junior High School during my first year.
Okay.
It was Hale, and then we went over to open up Einstein Junior High School, and both of them were in the Claremont area.
Okay. What was the racial balance there?
There was no balance.
Okay.
It was, there were two African-American teachers, me and one other person, and then there were, I think there were two black students who were the students of the other, of the teacher, the lady.
Oh, wow.
Okay. That was it.
And what year was this? Like 1950?
1960. I think I started in 1960 or 61 that I started teaching.
Since it was obvious you were the minority in many ways, how were you treated by students, parents,
well,
colleagues?
I always say that it depends on the leadership.
Mm-hmm. That's very
and
true.
As a, since management became, business management became my area, I talk about that a lot. Leadership is so important, and it sets the tone. No matter what organization you're in, and where I was in those schools, we had a person who was a very good leader as the principal of the school.
Mm-hmm.
And I had just a wonderful time there teaching. I loved teaching. I guess that may have been at the top of the list probably of my experiences.
Oh, great.
I loved teaching. I had the respect and the camaraderie of the faculty.
Mm-hmm.
And of course the principal, I mean, he was a person, I mean, he never said it or talked about it, but you know, he demanded that kind of school.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of school that he wanted.
So he set the tone.
He
so
set
from
the tone.
From
yes.
the top. That is very important.
He would not have tolerated any. In fact, Gloria, that was when I was leading the civil rights movement here in San Diego. So,
during your tenure at the
during
my junior
tenure
high school
at Einstein.
Okay.
Yes.
How did you get involved in that? Well, you came here at an early age, so.
Yeah, I was. I started out in the area of race relations in college in about 1950. Before I graduated,
mm-hmm.
It was about 1950.
While you were still here at San Diego State.
While I was here at San Diego State, I joined an organization on campus called the Wesley Foundation. And Wesley Foundation is a religious Methodist
right.
group.
You have a little, the house.
Oh, yeah, it's,
right
it's
there.
Still
yes.
there. Different location, but it was there when I was, Wesley Foundation was popular while I was a student here, and we went around. We had a group.
So it was a religious based foundation.
Mm-hmm. We had a group with in the Wesley Foundation that went around to various churches and places to speak on race relations, and I was one of those mm-hmm. who did that, and so. That's where I really got started in the area of race relations. Then I joined an organization called the El Cajon Valley Open Housing Committee, and that committee was concerned with integrating the neighborhoods in the La Mesa, El Cajon area. And so we did a number of things there and trying to, having petitions circulated for people to express themselves as to whether or not they would want a Negro back in those days, right, living next door to them, and those kinds of things.
Oh, okay.
And so I then was met a person by the name of Jim Stone, who Jim is now deceased, but he approached me and asked me if I had heard of the organization, the Congress of Racial Equality, mm-hmm, and CORE, and I don't know if I had or not. I probably hadn't at that time, and so he told me about it and invited me to join. I joined the organization and became its chairman after my first year of teaching. I accepted the nomination as a chairman of the group, in which I did,
okay,
and was elected as chairman, and that's where I spent, you know, the next 8 years leading the civil rights movement.
Okay. In San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
Who was Jim Stone? Was he affiliated with the group?
Yes, Jim was. I don't know what Jim's affiliation was, but he was aware of it and knew about it, and when we formed, a small group of us formed a chapter, mm-hmm, of the Congress of Racial Equality here, and then, you know, from then on it was CORE who was conducting demonstrations and marches and trying to break down segregation and discriminatory barriers, which we were successful in doing in conjunction with what was going on in the rest of the country.
What were some of the more visible disparities in San Diego at that time? What were what was the focus of CORE? I know with a group like that, you know, you have to take steps to, mm-hmm, break down those barriers. So what were sort of the key issues that you wanted to confront?
Our primary focus was in the area of job discrimination.
Okay.
I mean, it was just pathetic, but there just weren't the society. I always describe it as our economic society, our, mm-hmm, system of capitalism, I mean, was practically closed to blacks. I mean, you could go around in this city, as you could in most cities, and you wouldn't find any blacks working in areas. I mean, there weren't any working downtown. You know, you couldn't get a job as a cashier in a grocery store. You couldn't, drive a bus. You couldn't be a stockbroker. You couldn't be a a teller in a bank.
You couldn't even get blue collar, what considered blue collar jobs today. You couldn't even get those back in the day.
No.
So what were African Americans doing here?
Well,
or blacks and
there
Negroes?
Were some working out at General Dynamics.
Okay.
And some were, you know, we had some teachers.
In what capacity? At General Dynamics or in the Navy, I assume naval stations also.
Yeah, mostly General Dynamics where blacks were working, but there were also some people, I think, working at Roar and
Roar
Ryan.
Was what kind of a?
They were all mostly defense.
Okay.
Defense contractors and the others were, you know, working everything ranged from domestics to I guess working and
like were they working hotel, like in cafeterias retail, and you know cleaning in hotels
probably
and things
all
like
those
that. You said Ryan
R-Y-A-N okay. Ryan Aeronautical.
Okay. So you led the charge for CORE to sort of even the playing field and open up jobs. And how did the group go about that? So that was like the first civil rights group in San Diego that was in the organized front.
Mm-hmm. It was the only civil rights
organization. Was it led by African Americans?
Was it led? Led? Uh-huh. Yeah, I was the leader.
I mean, and the whole group was the membership.
Oh, the membership? No, the membership was mostly white. Oh, majority okay. were whites, and a considerable number of people of the Jewish faith, and because Jews understand slavery mm-hmm. and discrimination and stuff that they've experienced, even in this country, discrimination. But so, no, we had that was one of my big concerns was not being able to get much participation from the black community here mm-hmm. in San Diego. And even when, you know, there were a few of us who, you know, were arrested several times during demonstrations and had to spend time in jail and so on, but we couldn't get the Negro mm-hmm. population to participate to any degree. There were some in CORE, and but mostly the ones who were in CORE, blacks and whites, were most all professional okay. people.
Do you know? You have an idea why you didn't get a larger participation from the blacks at that time?
Yeah, I have an idea, but you know, I don't have any
right,
proof.
I
could cite a couple reasons, several reasons, probably at least I felt. One was that I always felt that fear was a great factor in that the blacks back in those, I mean, they were very much afraid, as they are today, of reprisals.
Mm-hmm.
In this country, whites had the money and the power, and power gives you the opportunity to make decisions
That's
regarding
correct.
Other people's lives. And when racism is involved, you can exercise that power in favor of your racist views.
Mm-hmm.
And so back in those days, I mean, blacks, just like in the South, knew pretty well what could happen to them. So I've always felt that the fear factor was great.
Mm-hmm.
There were a few who had the courage to take the risk, stick mm-hmm. their neck out, and because of what we believed in. But very few were willing to do that back in those times. And I think that was probably true throughout the United States. I
mm-hmm.
mean, even as much as we hail to the chief of Martin Luther King and so forth, I mean, you know, there were people who would not get involved back in those years. There weren't that many, especially
mm-hmm.
in the North and in the West.
Right.
There weren't that many blacks that were involved in the civil rights movement.
Okay.
Many like to take credit for it now, but they
right.
were not.
Hmm. So that was the political, was that the extent of your, I mean, it was great, but that was where your focus was politically, was to round the support for, to work on things that you saw that there were just, the equality wasn't there.
Yes, my I decided that I would, you know, commit my life to trying to erase the barriers that mm-hmm. were so apparent and to me as a kid growing up and being so affected by that, that I was determined to do what I could to remove those barriers so that my children would not have to go through that.
And, that's wonderful.
So that's what I did, and that moved not only into, I mean, it moved us not only into the job discrimination, but also it moved us into housing discrimination. Mm-hmm. I mean, blacks could not move to other areas of San Diego other than those confined areas that the so-called powers to be
right.
designated for blacks to live in. And okay. the other areas were closed to blacks because through the process of a housing covenant that
so it was legal.
There. Yeah, I mean, well, it was, yes, say it was legal. I'm not sure whether that was legal, but it was a practice.
Okay.
And it wasn't until the Rumford Act and, you know, the that addressed housing discrimination and so forth, what did it become actually illegal in the state of California to discriminate in housing on the basis of color or ethnicity. And so...
What year was the Rumford Act passed?
It
was in the 60s.
Yes, it was probably around 65, around in that area, okay. I think. But CORE was involved in our demonstrations were directed at housing discrimination as well as job discrimination.
So you had demonstrations, marches, rallies, and all of that?
Sit-ins and...
Oh, okay.
Sit-ins and marches and coin-ins and...
How did you get the word out? Through churches, flyers, social groups?
I
saw a smile on your face.
Because, I've always said that you can't have a movement without a communication system.
Mm-hmm.
And the best communication system that Negroes had back in those years and still have is the churches.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we would print flyers and distribute flyers around to churches and the various organizations, barbershops, beauty salons. And
some these things are
black
still the same.
Yes, it is still the same. And we were, some churches would accept us, others would not. I'm talking about all black churches.
Mm-hmm.
And so.
Oh, okay.
And then we had, what we had back in those days was a black newspaper called The Voice.
Which
was started by a friend of mine, and he through that Voice newspaper, we were able to get the word out to as what was going on.
So they had a pretty strong black readership.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The paper of The Voice and Viewpoint now, it still exists, but back in those days, Gloria, I mean, blacks through this system of discrimination, we lived in pockets
mm-hmm.
where around the country, it's true too, we lived in pockets where you knew people, where you could get to people, you know. And,
right.
And
yes, I do.
Yeah. And so, you know, now in San Diego, we're spread out.
Yes.
Over the place, but back then there was such a thing as a black community. where we had our, you know, our barbershops and beauty salons and churches and retail shops and things like that. Mm-hmm. We had some economic base within this whole city. Although there were pockets of blacks living in different areas of San Diego, just like in my hometown, there were pockets, a handful of blacks over here, right. A handful of blacks over at this part of town. But we pretty much knew everybody.
Exactly.
Because the number was small, mm-hmm. And we were pretty much all in the same area.
Now, when you finished, you were at the junior high school, and then you got involved with Corps. Mm-hmm. And then what were your other, how did you get involved with the business world?
Oh.
Was that right after your junior high experience?
Yes. Well, not immediately after.
Oh, okay.
But what I did was, although I was very, very happy teaching, mm-hmm. school. I wanted to something inside me. I wanted to move out and do some other things
that would make more of an impact to the community.
Yeah. So I decided, you know, I said, I want to get into business and learn business. And I've always had this thing inside me, this voice that was speaking to me over many years about the importance of economics. Mm-hmm. And so I decided to go into business and to go into the business world. And that's when while I was teaching school, I decided to learn about selling. So I went to car dealerships, right? And again, no blacks, mm-hmm. went there and finally got a job part-time selling cars.
Oh, okay.
And then, you know, I did that for a while, and I was invited to apply for a position with the United States Peace Corps. Mm-hmm. There was a position open as the deputy director in an African country. And so that was another fulfillment of mine, a desire to visit Africa and, mm-hmm. to find out, you know, firsthand what Africa was about. And so I applied for that position and was selected as the deputy director of the Peace Corps in Lesotho, Africa.
In where?
Lesotho. It's Lesotho, oh,
okay.
Or Lesotho as people.
Right, okay.
That's it. And so I did that, and one of the organizations that led up to that was, that I didn't mention, was we formed also in 1960, a group of us formed the Afro-American Association. And the purpose of that organization was to to inform and educate black Americans about our plight back in America.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a very interesting experience, too. As I said, a small group.
Who were you informing?
African Americans.
Throughout others, San Diego or the world?
Just San Diego.
I mean, okay.
San Diego. I mean, we held rallies, and we would go to parks, and we would speak on Sundays, every Sunday at a park. And so... And then we have various activities.
Mm-hmm.
But that was, you know, one of the things. And the person who started that group, the name was Joshua Von, V-O-N, Woolfolk, W-O-L-F-O-L-K.
V-O-N? Joshua Von Wolfolk.
Von Wolfolk.
Okay.
And Joshua was an older, a little older than we were, and had introduced us to a number of things.
I would assume African American?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yes. And he introduced us, you know, to a number of things regarding, you know, our life here in America. And you know, I would, you know, kind of, if I had to describe it, I would say it was almost like a forerunner to the Black Muslims.
Okay.
Philosophy.
Okay.
Although, you know, it wasn't that. I mean, I don't even know if, yeah, I guess I did know about the Muslims back in that year. But
so it had some of those same...
It was to educate the Black man.
Okay. Okay. Good way to put it.
Yes.
Okay.
So that was my introduction to that, and of course we did a lot of reading and a lot of studying and discussing, and to educate ourselves, and as well as trying to educate other Blacks. And so, you know, we...
So this Afro-American Association was a spinoff from CORE?
No.
No?
It was a forerunner to CORE.
Oh, it's, okay.
I was in that before I became the chairman of CORE. It was almost like simultaneously done. And we, the Afro-American Association was not an organization that did address the issues of job discrimination per se, or housing, or education per se.
It was just more to mentor the core values of being an African American. This group was more involved in the inner person and getting things right as a person.
Yes.
Character, building character, moral values, and
exactly.
all of that.
Exactly. A lot of the mental part.
Mm-hmm.
And CORE was involved, of course, with attacking those issues directly to produce tangible results. You know?
Actually, that's a pretty good thing, work from within to strengthen who you are when you go out, too.
Absolutely.
That's really wonderful.
And it fit well with me, because when I started out speaking in the Wesley Foundation, I spoke just about every time on the importance of self-concept.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my theme. And I guess, you know, people say, well, why did I speak about that? I guess it was because I was speaking to myself.
Mm-hmm.
And growing up in a segregated society and discriminated on the basis of your color and all of the subtleties of the racial situation, it's very easy to grow up with an inferiority complex.
That's right. Or that and or anger and with issues.
Absolutely.
And, right.
Absolutely. With anger, which, you know,
doesn't
we'll talk about
anything.
Later probably. But
the membership for the Afro-American Association, was it both genders, male, female, or?
Yes.
And all African-American, Afro-Americans.
It was open to all African-Americans, but only a small group of us were in that organization, too, just like CORE.
Okay.
You see, back in those days, what I would like.
So the makeup was whites.
No, this was the Afro American Association.
It was totally
was all
that's
black.
Right. Okay. But even though it was all black, you didn't have that many who participated in or became members. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
See, one of the things that we tried to educate people about was color, and how color had become such a dominant feature in America, and how color was used as the expression goes, a badge of dishonor. It was also perceived as a badge of ignorance and mm-hmm. and
all those negatives.
All those negatives and so forth. So that's what black was, and so that's how they defined it. And we, you know, and no one, you know, people didn't want to discuss that. Blacks didn't want to discuss that. I mean, blacks were afraid. It was the Afro-American Association, we introduced the word black into San Diego.
Oh, okay.
You know, we introduced that word. I mean, we, and I was the one who, you know, introduced it at our black summit. Mm-hmm. We had decided that we would no longer use the word Negro, and we would use substitute the word black, because Negro was only meant black in Spanish anyhow. And mm-hmm. we said we didn't speak Spanish.
Okay.
So we were speaking English. And so we introduced that word, but when we would use the word black, we could see other blacks recoil.
Okay.
I mean, they hated to hear that word. I mean, because it was always used negatively
right.
against us. And when we would introduce each other as a black person mm-hmm. or talk about black people, I mean, they hated our guts. People, I mean, the blacks, they didn't want to hear that.
Okay.
So it was a grinding away at helping people to understand that the word Negro was, you know, just something that was used by the white community to describe us and had all the negative
right.
Meanings of the word. So
sort of like it was, we were miseducated.
Yeah,
so,
right.
So you
without
had to
a doubt.
Yeah,
without a doubt.
Teach
and of course,
again.
Of course, there's been books written by African American authors on our miseducation.
That's right.
And so when we, that was a really a wonderful experience, because not only did we study and learn ourselves, but we were able to teach other people. So we introduced into San Diego the concept, the foreign concept of Negro history.
Okay.
Which was accepted about as well as a severe cold
okay.
in winter. People, and I'm talking about blacks. I mean, they didn't. I'm going through my mind now. I mean, there are times when we were challenged and mm-hmm. so strongly about what in the
by having a week. Well, at that time, a week to really talk about the accomplishments of the black person.
Yeah.
And
yeah. We set up classes in Negro history.
Yeah.
To and I even taught on, you know, young people on an individual basis, you know, about, you know, black history,
mm-hmm.
where did we come
right.
from, and you know, who are we today, how did we get here? See, that's why it's so important. What we're doing now is to try to help people understand how we got here on March 30th, 2010. How
that's
did
it.
We get here?
Right.
And not, we don't mean how did we physically travel. How did we get here
as a
to
people.
Where we are? Exactly.
And it is
as
important.
A people.
And you know, this, the, and our students know Martin Luther King, Rosa Parks, and but you're right. They don't know the history of what the whole makeup of San Diego is about. And like you said,
exactly.
how did you get to where you are today?
Exactly.
And how did you get to a Lincoln High School or whatever
yes.
school you're in?
Or how did
or
you
how
get
did
to
you,
this position to
right.
As an executive?
That's it, right.
At Bank of America
mm-hmm.
or one of these other companies, you know,
that's
IBM,
right.
not IBM, but American Express and
mm-hmm.
all. I mean, how did you get to these? How did we get there?
Right.
That wasn't there.
That's right.
In fact, I mean, if you even had revealed a thought that you would want a position
right.
like that, you'd probably kill.
Yeah. They'd be like Joseph in the Bible. Put him in a prison for years.
So,
but this is important. Out of
yes.
all the accomplishments of CORE, and I know there were many, what do you think were the three most important accomplishments as far as people moving forward, and specifically African Americans moving forward in San Diego?
Without a doubt, it was our addressing the job discrimination in San Diego. I mean, CORE was the only organization that was out there beating the drums and fighting for destruction of those barriers that would not give opportunities to blacks and, of course, any non-white opportunities for jobs. Now, that was really, I mean, if we look at San Diego then, mm-hmm. and look at San Diego now, or even the year 2000 or 1990,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, if we measured the difference then, you would see that that's the vast difference in African Americans now having opportunities in so mm-hmm. much of our economic system now than we had back in those days. And so, I mean, I look at my sons. I mean, my sons could never be doing the things that they are doing now if they had grown up during my era.
Mm-hmm.
They just were
How many sons do you have?
Two.
Two? And where are they?
One is in Philadelphia, who teaches at the at Temple University, and previously taught it at University of Maryland. And my other son is in San Jose, and he's a senior vice president of the company in business. I mean, those are positions
yes.
that you couldn't even dream of. I mean, we in San Diego, when I came out here, we had you know, a few black teachers who taught in schools in the black areas,
mm-hmm. right?
And we had lawyers who had law offices. They didn't work mm-hmm. for any of these law firms. They had their own businesses,
right,
in the black community, except one, and he was downtown. So I mean, you know, you could go on and mm-hmm. on. You couldn't work in banks or in stores. I mean, unless you were cleaning them up, or
right.
as a custodian, and so forth. So I mean, and CORE addressed those issues, mm-hmm. and we were very unpopular. We were hated by many people. We were shunned by blacks, and.
That I can imagine back in the day looked at CORE as troublemakers.
Oh, they called us troublemakers, communists.
Wow.
What was the other?
They had just accepted the status quo.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And didn't think there was a way to improve. And all it took was...
When you say they, you're referring to who?
African-Americans.
The African-Americans.
Yeah.
I don't know whether they... I mean, such a mixture of feelings, I guess, back in those days. There were some who supported us but did not participate.
Okay, okay.
And
like you said earlier, out of fear of...
Yeah, most did not, and others who... And some of those who... I mean, there were those as many who didn't agree with what we were doing as those who agreed. And so we were kind of left out there, you know, by ourselves. Mm-hmm. But you know, that's why I felt it was so important when this library, my alma mater, mm-hmm. my where my career was, and where I'm now. An alumnus and a retired administrator and so on. When they did this thing about the exhibit about African American experience, mm-hmm. and never even mentioned the civil rights movement, which was the most important thing that happened in our cities and
right.
in our country to African Americans during that period. I mean, that
right.
was it. And so
it was definitely a vacuum, a hole that was really big.
Absolutely.
So I'm glad we have an opportunity to include such a pivotal movement and point in San Diego history. So because my thing is, it would have been a disservice to students.
Young
people, they need to know this, and this is really, you know, where they can do what they can do now based on that foundation that was, you know, back in the day, as they said.
Absolutely. And also, Gloria, it was, you're right, it was a disservice, a serious disservice to the students, but it's a disservice to all of America who don't really understand that period, or have some understanding and some acceptance of what happened. Because my thing is that if you don't know that, and you don't know what happened, you don't have a pretty good idea of what went on. Things can happen in the future that you have no idea about that will cause the same conditions that we had back in those years.
That is true.
And that's one of the issues that I have. The other issue is that I think America as a nation needs to feel some pride in having come through that
period. Oh, absolutely. Right.
I mean, that was an accomplishment. I mean, those were some growing times and troubled times that we as a nation came through that period.
Right.
And we ought to be able to say, hey, I mean,
You're talking about overcoming. This is one of the things,
absolutely. Yeah. And not push it back up under a rug and don't want to discuss it like we're doing in America today.
Yes, I agree. What, one of the things on here is law enforcement. What were your perceptions of the police, and did you have any encounters with them in working and marching in demonstrations? And I can imagine you did have some encounters with police.
Oh, yes. Yeah, the law enforcement, including the courts and everything, I mean, they were practicing law, and they weren't interested in who discriminated against whom and all that. You broke the law, you went to jail. Okay. We knew that, we understood that, we accepted that. But we were not going to let it keep us from breaking the law when we felt those laws were unjust and unfair. And so we did that. And we were arrested and we served our time. But, you know, we were never actually... none of us were really mistreated by the law enforcement people here. They arrested us, and the few of us who were arrested, they arrested us, and I personally was never mistreated. I was not handcuffed. They marched me over to the car, put me in a police car, and take me to jail.
Okay.
And the chief of police and others were perceived by the black community of us as part of the racist system in America, and they carried out their duties well.
Okay.
One of the things that I always mention when it comes to law enforcement is that they learned too.
All right.
And I have a specific example, a personal example of that learning. I was arrested by once or twice or so, I don't know how many times, arrested by a person by the name of Bill Collender, who was he was a patrolman back then.
Okay.
And he became the chief of police, and then he became the sheriff. Sure. Well, Bill you know, on the way down, we would talk and about, you know, these demonstrations, mm-hmm. what I was doing, why I was doing it, blah, blah, blah. Bill and I grew into a great friendship over the years.
Wow.
And
So he had respect for what you were doing and the way you were doing
Yes, and he appreciated that.
Okay.
And
that's wonderful.
I guess maybe it had something to do with he is Jewish. And mm-hmm. As I said earlier, Jews understand slavery. They understand discrimination.
Right.
So I'm sure as he grew up, he was exposed to some of that too. But he did. He understood it. But, I mean, out of, I guess my point is that, you know, out of struggle and turmoil and hatred mm-hmm. and all of that can grow some positive things. And people can grow from that and learn from that, as that example I just mm-hmm. Explained. I mean, Bill grew, and I'm sure others grew
right.
as well through that experience. But I can't say enough about those people who participated back during mm-hmm. those years. And that's why I'm just going to fight with all my might to make sure that somehow they are remembered and that they are appreciated.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yes.
Yeah.
They did a tremendous job.
Now, you sort of hit on the housing earlier. Mm-hmm. You were saying we were African-Americans or blacks lived in pockets. What was the racial situation of those? Or it was just, okay, we're here and everybody's gotten along okay, and did whites interfere, or it was just, this is our, meaning African-American area, and, you know, we do our thing here?
As I understand it, when blacks first came to this area of San Diego County, and they were given places, not really given, they were allowed to live in a certain area.
Okay.
And southeastern San Diego became that area, but it was an area called Logan Heights,
mm-hmm.
which was an area that was synonymous with black.
Okay.
And that's where most of the blacks lived. We lived over in those areas. And then you had another pocket that was in Linda Vista. You had another pocket of blacks, and then there was another pocket, excuse me, out in, now I can't remember the name of that pocket of blacks that lived out. There was another area. Of course, you had a small pocket in La Jolla of domestics.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, I think that was a characteristic of San Diego, is that that's where we lived in Logan Heights, and then moved, then southeast San Diego. Logan Heights was part of southeast San Diego. Then blacks started living in outside of Logan Heights in the other parts of southeast San Diego, and for many, many years that was the area where blacks live, and many whites today still think that that's where we live in mm-hmm. southeast San Diego. I say many whites. I probably shouldn't say that. There are
some
whites. Yes.
Yes.
It just happened the other day where a white person who knows us fairly well knows me and my wife fairly well. They know our mm-hmm. background pretty much, and
right.
they know where we live and so But he referred to where we live over there, which he meant we lived over there in Southeast San Diego from out here in the San Diego State University area.
Okay.
So, I mean, as recently as a few days ago, so he was saying that. I mean, he was
kind of stuck.
Well-meaning,
did not
nice
want
person.
To.
Yeah, I mean, he thinks we're all still living over there. Yeah, he didn't know we. Now, that's a good thing, but you know.
That's very interesting.
Another good thing about you, it goes even back to when you asked me about my childhood. You know, you were laughing and I'm laughing, and we find the humor in that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of the things that was so nice about growing up in the family where I grew up. We had such a great sense of humor. Humor was just there all the time. We find humor in so many things that probably weren't very humorous.
Right. But it was, I think, how we dealt with the issue. Even now, my family gets together every Christmas in North Carolina, and it's different for the young kids. Like, my son is 23, mm-hmm. and it's different for his age group, because we go over the same stories and we laugh.
Same here. Same you know. Here.
And he's just, okay.
I know. Even I get tired of those stories.
Right, exactly. But they always come
the
up.
Same stories over and over and over.
Oh, that is so
my
true.
My wife has to sit through that
right.
stuff. She kind of enjoys it, too.
Yeah, but it's just, I think, I'm just interjecting a personal, mm-hmm. we have to hold on to it. To appreciate where we are.
Absolutely.
And hopefully get our children to, you know, things weren't always like you're experiencing,
right.
you know, mom and same. Grandma, you know, had to go through some
that's
things.
That's right. Sure did. Oh, boy.
Mm. Now, you came here and as a student, so you lived on campus? Was there
no,
on
campus? There was no campus housing.
Okay.
I lived because as I mentioned, I was in the Army, and I was discharged from the Army. I came back to school, and we had veterans housing.
Oh, okay.
And there were two
in San
sections.
Diego.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
There were two sections in San Diego of veterans housing.